Zamira asked me to speak about Teves today. And the funny thing is I wasn't very connected to Teves before this year. But I thought to myself, well, okay, it makes sense. You know, she wanted me to bring in my life story. I don't know if anyone's heard anything about... raise your hand if you've heard anything about my story. One, not two, okay. Not three. Hi, welcome. So I thought, all right, you know what? It made sense. When we first think of Teves, what do we think of? I think of Yud Teves, right? It's a fast day. It's Rabbah Teves. It's when the walls of Yerushalayim were breached. What happened then? You know, that was the beginning. That was the beginning of the end for us. You know, it led to the first Churban Beis Hamikdash a few years later. We were basking in the Shekhinah, and all of a sudden, you know, that was it. That was it for us. That led to the beginning of the end, Gullis, and Hashem leaving our home, Hashem leaving his presence from us. You know, what could be sadder than that, than not feeling Hashem's presence? And then we think of the 8th of Teves, when the Torah was translated into Greek. You know, they put 70 sages into different rooms, and they translated the Torah into Greek. Now, some people would think, well, what's the big deal? You know, we're spreading light to the nations. But actually, Chazal compares this to the Chet HaEgel, because the purpose of this was actually to Hellenize the Torah, to actually put the Torah on the same shelf as everything else. There's Aristotle, there's the Torah, there's science, there's nature. It's not that at all. Just like what we did in the Chet HaEgel, which was, you know, we couldn't understand this infinite God, so we brought him down to like this human form that we could understand, which is a tragedy. It's a tragedy. We can't bring him down. We can't bring God to, you know, a human form or what we can understand. God is beyond us, and he should remain that way. So likened to that is the Torah being made into an idol. And then we think of the 9th of Teves. We think of Ezra and Nehemiah being killed, some of the greatest leaders we ever had. They brought the entire Jewish people back to Tshuva, back from Babylon to Israel. After them, we all went down. So how many sad events, how many tragic events happened in Teves? And I thought to myself, well, okay, so they want me to speak. Makes sense that they would want me to speak. I'll talk about my tragedy. I'll talk about everything I went through, all the sadness that I went through. There's a lot to complain about in Teves. For those of you who aren't familiar, 4 years ago, I was 39 years old. Bel Tshuva from America, had accomplished a lot in my life back in the day, or at least by secular standards. I was a lawyer. I was in the film business, and Baruch Hashem, you know, I found Torah. One of those stories you hear about, you know, going up to India and discovering the purpose of life and coming back, and the light went on. I married Baruch Hashem, a Ben Torah. I decided to do what, you know, my Rebbetzin said was the absolute greatest purpose in life, which was to learn Torah, live in Eretz Israel, and be a serious nefesh for the Klal. So Baruch Hashem, I met a wonderful guy who was on the same page as me. We both had very big spiritual ideals, and we were willing to go the distance, you know, no matter whether or not we knew our paycheck was coming at the end of the month. It didn't really matter. You know, we both understood that we were just going for gold, and we just wanted to bring the most light into the world as much as we could, you know, within the scope of our own personal midas and what we could handle. So Baruch Hashem, I got married, I settled down in the old city, by Nace we stayed, and my husband learned full-time, and eventually he became the head of his yeshiva. Financially, he was responsible for the entire budget, Birkas HaTorah. And he still remained learning three sadarim a day. Nice. I saw him for exactly 26 minutes at lunchtime, not a minute more. Baruch Hashem, we had a bunch of kids. We were living what we thought, you know, was the right thing to do. And like I said, minding my own business one day, it was his 40th birthday, and we decided to go away for Shabbos to spend some time together, get to know each other again. I'm just kidding. Once a week, actually, for 11 years, we had a date night. And through that, Baruch Hashem, we survived, and our marriage thrived. And I highly, highly recommend that no matter what, it was really our dogma, no matter what, we go out on date night and we do not talk about kids. And thank God, so we were able to grow together despite the 26 minutes doing the diapers and the vomiting and the screaming. Okay, so Baruch Hashem, we had that time away that we would go away actually every 6 weeks. And this time, it was a beautiful event. It was his 40th birthday. And anyone who's hit 40 knows it's a very big deal. You know, it's like you've been climbing, and you don't realize anything, and all of a sudden you get to this top of the mountain, and you're like, whoa, what did I do? Where am I, and do I like it here? So at that point, you either, you know, buy a Rolls Royce and get a younger wife, or you pat yourself on the back, and you say, wow, kol hakavod, I got to where I wanted to go. Or you take a big U-turn, and you say, okay, now it's time to go to where I want to go. So Baruch Hashem, we were in the second category. It was the first time in my life I'd ever heard my husband pat himself on the back, ever. And he just kept talking about how grateful he was and how much he accomplished, and I just didn't know who I was looking at. I couldn't believe it. He spent the entire morning calling every rabbitson and rabbi he ever had to say thank you. Thank you, look what I've done with my life. I can't believe it. And you know, they say, and Hashem knows 40 days before they're gonna go, and everyone around them too. So in some ways, it was a hint to him understanding that he was really at the end. We went down to the beach. He used to be a beach lifeguard back before he was a tzaddik. That was a tzaddik lifeguard for the kids. And it was Erev Shabbos, and he went into Toivo, a private part of Tel Aviv Beach, very far away. And unfortunately, there was a storm that was coming, and we didn't know. And I'll spare you all the gory details, but I had to pull him out of the water 20 minutes after he had been hit by a rock in the back of his head and submersed so far away that absolutely nobody could get to him. So, there's a lot I could say about that Erev Shabbos. Needless to say, there were many, many people crying at the Kotel. And not the least of which was his soon-to-be widow wife crying by his bedside by myself after I just lit the candles for Shabbos in the ICU. By the time it was 8 o'clock Sunday morning, a very sleepless 36 hours, I'd actually written a few articles about that time because, wow, life or death moments can just bring out incredible epiphanies. You should never know. But basically, as the line on the screen went flat, and as we said our goodbyes and all our forgiveness and all our vidus and all our messages for the future, I made the first call to my Chinuch Rebbetzin to say, what in the world do I do now? What do I tell these kids? And so in, you know, they hear about these stories where women, when their kids are stuck under a car, all of a sudden they become, you know, Wonder Woman, and they're able to lift up this, you know, 1,000-ton thing and get their kid out, and they're like, who was that? So they call it adrenaline. You could call it God, you can call it whatever you want, but somehow I had it in me to make it home, to have the kids separated so that the thousands of people in the streets who were spreading the news wouldn't let them know, and I had them isolated until they came home one by one, and I was able to explain to them in whatever way they were able to hear one by one that they weren't going to see their father for a while. Maybe they were going to feel him. They definitely should take some messages from him, but the relationship was going to change. From now on, instead of him doing for them, they're going to do for him. They're going to do all the things he can't do anymore. That's why they tuck their tzitzit in when they go say Kaddish for him, because It's hard for him. It's hard for him to see that he can't do any of these mitzvahs anymore. And now it's their turn. It's their turn to give him what he can't give for himself. It's their turn to bring light to him and bring nachas to him and bring him the only thing he ever wanted, which was to get closer to God, learn a lot of Torah, and do a lot of mitzvahs. And then they could do that for him. And that was their way to give back to him now. And he would give back to them by davening for them and helping them through their life. So, naturally I thought, you know, the Shekhinah sort of left our house that day. I remember looking around saying, wow, he kept all the pillars of his home together. He told me the halacha for absolutely everything. He brought Torah into the house. What in the world am I going to do? Who's going to keep up the spiritual pillars of this house? Where's the Shekhinah? So I thought, wow, absolutely. Hashem leaving us, the Beis HaMikdash, Galus. Of course he would want me to speak. But then, I got to know a little bit more about Teves. And I realized that that's probably not the message here. You know, Esther was actually taken to Ahasuerus in the 10th month, which is the 10th month after Nisan, which is Teves. She was pulled away from her family. She was taken away from her Jewishness, her husband. Kind of a horrible tragedy. You know, we don't think of it like that. We think Purim, the Purim story, revelation of God, hashgacha, fun. You know, it's such a big deal that at the end of the day in the Purim story that we see that Hashem was with us all the time, that we don't even care at the fact that all the little details, that look what happened to Esther. You know, her life was ruined. Look what she had to do day to day. She lost everything. But some of you, like, those are like little fine details in the whole story, because the whole story, the whole point of the story is, wow, Hashem's with us. Look what he does for us. Look at all the hashgacha. And we get so much pleasure and so much light and so much fulfillment from this that what's the big deal? So, you know, one woman had to go through a bunch of stuff. Look, Hashem's with us. But let's go back to this. This really is a real life story. This really was a real person. This really happened to her. I mean, can you imagine your cousin Sarah? You know, she's driving through whatever area and by accident she takes a turn into Ramallah. And Baruch Hashem, she gets saved, but, you know, in the process she gets taken up to Arafat. And he likes her. He likes her. And he says, you know what? No one's going to know she's Jewish. I'll take her in. I'll throw a scarf on her head. No one's going to know. I could use her as a wife. And it's crazy, right? You get Yad Le'achim over here, Tehillim groups, Kotel gatherings. This is nuts. A Jewish woman gets captured by a Saudi or a Palestinian leader. This is no place for a Jewish woman. This is an absolute tragedy. It's horrible. But in dream, this is a really big deal. Especially if it's your cousin. Especially if it's your wife. What about him? How's he going to marry again? How's he going to get her? We're all going to write our senator or this or that. Imagine how she's feeling the first day, the second day. Trapped, helpless. It was a long time later until she had an opportunity to do something good with her horrible situation. So, this is where Teves gets a bit interesting. The word Teved actually comes from Tov, which means good. And isn't it interesting in the month where there's so many tragedies and so much to cry about and so much to complain about? The month actually starts with Hanukkah. You know, we think Hanukkah, Kislev, lights, miracles, donuts, dreidels. But actually, the end of Hanukkah starts in Teves. And we know that the more lights that we light, the greater the spiritual light is in the world. And the greatest part of Hanukkah, the greatest light in Hanukkah, is not in Kislev, it's in Teves. And Zos Hanukkah, which is, you know, the day of the absolute greatest light available in the entire year, Zos Hanukkah is when a simple Jew can actually accomplish what a tzaddik can accomplish on Yom Kippur. Zos Hanukkah, the light of Or HaGanuz, is actually available, which is the 36 hours of spiritual light that Hashem put into the world before creation. This is the light of Mashiach. This is not in Kislev, it's in Teves. The light of Mashiach, the real spiritual light, the revelation of God, is in Teves. the same month that Esther was brought to the king, where she had this horrible, terrible nisayon. So we see that there's a connection between some of the tragedies, some of the hardships in our life, and the incredible revelation of Hashem, an incredible revelation of light. You know, I'll tell you something that happened. When I was on my first day of Shiva, I was feeling a little down. My life was over, you know. Somehow I had to go up there and sit, because that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to sit as people come in, which is interesting. Really all you want to do is just, you know, cry and go under the covers, but you have to go up and greet everyone you've ever met in your entire life, and everyone your spouse has ever met in their entire life, and talk. So, because no one's allowed to talk to you. So I got upstairs, you know, and I greeted, you know, after having not slept for 36 hours and gone through insane amounts of trauma. I remember seeing his Rosh Yeshiva and his entire yeshiva there, and I said, okay, I could use a little pick-me-up right now. I said, you know, they say, Hashem says that a husband and a spouse are really one neshama. You know, one neshama, four arms, four legs, whatever he does, it's really yours. Whatever you do, it's really his. I said, you guys all owe me now. He was running this yeshiva as I was cleaning up vomit and doing lots of diapers. I said, I want to know what he was doing. Give me something. You know, give me something to make me feel good. I want to know what he was doing out there while I was sitting here cleaning up the mess and the dishes and everything that's very inspiring to do. So in order to make the almana happy, the Rosh Yeshiva sat down and said, okay, Maya wants to know what Gershom was doing. I'm going to tell you what he was doing. He sat down and looked at the guy next to him, and he said, Mark. He said, Mark came to our yeshiva a few years ago, and Gershon asked me to accept him. Now, Mark didn't look like the rest of the guys here. He jumped very high during our tefillas, and he loved to wear lots of colors, and I couldn't imagine how in the world he's going to sit for this many hours. So when Gershon asked me to take in Mark, I said, no way. He does not fit in here at all. How in the world is he going to be successful amongst a bunch of black and white learners? And Gershom said, no, you don't understand. Ignore what he looks like on the outside. He's really one of us. He really is going to, he's going to do really well here. So the rabbi said, listen, he doesn't look like he has any money. Can he pay tuition? And Gershom said, I don't think so. He said, I'm sorry, no scholarships available. See you later. He said, no, hold on. I'm going to go call his parents. I'm going to call his parents and I'm going to see, maybe they can help out. He said, okay, fine. Came back the next day, he said, I talked to his parents, they're willing to pay some of the tuition, and the rest of it that he's not paying, he'll be able to work off through odd jobs. The Rosh Yeshiva really wasn't happy about it, but you know, Gershom was like really pleading his case. They said, listen, I'll give him 2 weeks. After 2 weeks, if he's still not fitting in, he's gone. He said, I look to my right now, and Mark has become one of the top yeshiva students in the entire place. He actually teaches now. He's an Eloi. He could give shir at any Yerushalayim yeshiva. Still jumping. Still in his colors. And a couple years later, the Rosh Yeshiva saw Mark selling flowers for about 20 shekels an hour. And he thought to himself, how in the world does Mark afford $18,000 in tuition when he's sitting here slumping around for 20 shekels? And he called his parents, and he started talking to his parents, and he realized that his parents weren't paying a thing. And he came up to Gershom, and he said, what gives? And Gershom had to admit to them that he had paid his tuition. And as Mark looked at the Rosh Yeshiva in the middle of all these people on the first day of Shiva, trying to make me happy, he said, there's tuition at this yeshiva? And that started the game. That started the game of seeing how much we could possibly find out about the goodness that a person did without telling a soul. One story after the next story after the next story. Someone walked in one day and said, I know you don't know this one. I said, really, how do you know? He said, I know you don't know this one. People think you know, but you don't know. Do you know about the balloons? What balloons? She said, there happens to be a store in the old city that sells a bunch of different crafts. Now, what they do is, it's very cute. Every time a kid in the old city has a birthday, they actually give out a free helium balloon to them. And every time they have a siyum, or a bar mitzvah, or something to do with Torah, they give out two, because you get two for Torah. Now, the Israelis, where we live around, really, you know, they always kind of laugh at this American gashmias thing. You know, all the Americans with all their stuff as they eat up their pasta and their white bread and just live for the sake of Hashem and His Torah. But I've actually overheard people saying, well, you know, these Americans, they actually have something. You know, these balloons make people happy. Maybe they have something. So it turns out that this entire idea was my husband's. And at the end of every month, he would slip in and pay the bill for the balloons. And my children looked at me and they said, now we get it, Ima. I said, why? They said, because when it was Abba's birthday, we told him that we could actually run to this house and get balloons from the craft store for him and get a present for him. And we ran and we brought him this helium balloon, and then the way it popped. And we said, Abba, we want to go back and get another one. And he said, no, don't be silly. They said, no, it's okay. They'll give us another one. It popped. They'll give us another one. He's like, no, don't worry about it. They said, now we get it. He was paying for his own birthday present. So I could actually go on and on. During the Shiva, it actually became a fun game to distract our sadness. And Sarah Wigler actually wrote an article about this. It's called The Secret Life of Gershon Bird. It was published on H.com, and it became the number one article on H.com of all time. There were people who did tshuva from this article. There were people who became Gary from this article. Because it could not understand how it's possible that a person just wanted to give and not receive anything back. And it's something so inherently godly that it didn't matter whether someone was religious, not religious, Jewish, not Jewish. We all recognize godly traits. We all recognize where we come from. How many times have you seen a tree with a little, like, made by God? You know, Picasso, do you think he had a work that didn't have his name on it? Hashem hides behind every beautiful creation he has. There's nothing, no more beautiful artwork than Hashem has, and he doesn't take credit for any of it. We have to find it. So in the end, actually, a book was written called The Secret Life of Gershon Bird, and I cannot tell you how much of a Kiddush Hashem it has been. It's scary to say, but the light that he revealed through this tragedy was so unbelievably great that I hesitate to say I don't know how much it would have compared to how much he could have achieved in his lifetime, despite his entire goal being, I just want to get close to God and be a Kiddush Hashem. You know, Hashem leads you in the way you want to go. And sometimes it could be in life, and sometimes it could be in death and a tragedy. But the point is that so too, and in congruence with the tragedy, was a revelation of so much incredible light and so much incredible hashgacha and such a tikkun in the world that was done through it. Now, we're not here to judge whether or not something should happen or something should not happen. That's not our place, because we just show up in this world and we look around and we say, who are we? What are we doing here? And we go from there. Okay, so we know that actually each Chodesh has a letter that's associated with it. And the letter of Teves is Ayin. What does Ayin mean? Ayin means eye, to see. What do? With the Hanukkah candles, we use our eyes. We see, we gaze, we see the light. We experience with our eyes into our neshamas, experience of spiritual light. And our avoda in Teves is actually to have an ayin tov with anything that happens, and that's how we nullify the ayin ra, the evil eye, is we have an ayin tov. We look at it and we see what's the good. What good can we bring out of this ra, of this seemingly ra that we see when we're younger? We see ra. And as we grow up, we see and we bring out and we choose the good. We choose to see the good as much as we can. That's our avoda. So that actually brings us back to Esther. Okay. Now, based on what I'm talking about, how Esther was brought into this horrible place, really the story could have been very, very different. We'll look at it like this is an automatic result of what happened to her, but it is absolutely not. She is a human being. Look at it. She could have looked at things differently. She was a victim. She was mamash a victim. She lost her home. She lost her husband. She lost her freedom. She didn't ask for that nisayon. She could have spent her years drowned in self-pity. I was a good person, God. I was minding my own business. What is this? Do I deserve this? What is this? I'm a Jew. All my friends are at home baking challah, raising kids. But I'm sitting here in some crazy place. How am I supposed to keep Shabbos? How am I supposed to keep kosher? How am I supposed to be with my husband? How am I supposed to, I don't understand. You gave me the Torah, and I'm supposed to keep it, and now you put me in this crazy place, and you trap me here? What is this? What am I going to do now? She could have felt very, very sorry for herself for a long, long time. Why me? Why does this have to happen to me? This didn't happen to anybody else. What is this? So why didn't she drown in self-pity? It looked very unfair. It looked like a very, very unfair thing to do. Take her away from her husband. She couldn't even give her a get. Is it going to give her a get? Who knows? Can he move on? Can she not move on? And look, for a long time, she did not know the purpose of what she was doing there. She didn't even know there was a purpose. I'm sure deep inside of her, she had the emunah to understand everything's from Hashem, but azma. So she has a tikkun to do. She did something in a past life. She has to just look up. She didn't know for a very long time that there's anything that she's actually put there for to influence the world in any way. And she had to go through this. And to some extent, we all have to go through this all the time when things are just dark and we're just put in a place that we didn't choose to be. And we don't see what we're doing there or why we're doing there. But eventually she did get to a place where she saw, I must be suffering through Hashgacha. I must be suffering for a reason. And now in front of me, I see a potential reason, a potential tov. I can see a potential tov I can do with this ra. A potential good from all of this craziness and all of this suffering for absolutely who knows why. And fine, I wouldn't have chosen this place. I wouldn't have chosen to be in this palace. I wouldn't have chosen to be around all of these goyim and lose my life and lose my freedom. But at least I can do this. At least I can do this. I have an opportunity to do some good here that nobody else can do because of this crazy situation I'm in. So I'm going to do it. I'm going to do some good here. Instead of sitting and drowning away in self-pity, look what happened to me. And she did. Look, it happened to be extremely newsworthy. You know, she happened to save the entire Jewish people and be written down for the Book of Life, whatever. But, you know, at the end of the day, she couldn't be with Mordechai again. That was it. At the end of the day, she lost her husband forever. But at the end of the day, through her tragedy, we see so much light revealed in the world. And Hashem revealed so much light in the world. There's a direct correlation. And at the end of the day, some of us will see, a lot of us will see, that a lot of the very negative things that have happened to us, either through other people or in life situations, were sometimes the place that we actually became the greatest in those areas. Then we use that situation, we use those tragic circumstances, and we use that pain, and we look and we see, what good can I find in this? What good can I see in the suffering, and what good can I bring out of myself, or what good can I help with another person in the suffering? Because there's always a light to bring out in everything that happens that's negative. And that's our avodah, and that's Teves. To look with an ayin tov and to see, where can I bring out the spiritual light in the negative things, in the sad things, in the horrible things that are happening. What can I do? Because behind this is hashgacha. So every chodesh actually has a part of the body that's associated with it. And in the chodesh of Teves, it's actually the liver. Now, what's interesting about the liver, it's actually the only part of the body that if you cut it, it'll actually grow back by itself. It's amazing. Hashem actually made it that there's a part of our body who will regenerate and become healthy on its own, without the transplants, without the other people's blood, by itself, within ourselves where we're damaged, we can actually become whole, regenerate, and be healthy on our own. Now, I want to tell you that my husband's death was the last day of my life as I knew it. I remember once asking somebody about the purpose of life, and she said, you know, I think most people live for one of three things. They live for their children, they live for God, or they live for the husbands. I said, you know, I lived for my husband. Which is weird, I think most people live for their children, most women live for the children, but I really lived for my husband. And so when my husband was gone, I was gone. The purpose of my life, the fuel of my soul, the everything I'm doing on a daily basis, I was just gone, really. I mean, I looked on the outside like a human being who's alive, but inside I didn't feel any blood running or any pulse running. I'd be walking through my shiva just telling everybody like my life memoirs, like, here you go, you listen, you should know this, and you should know this, and you should know this. There was no ego left. You know, I told rabbis, I told this, I said, I'm sorry, that's wrong. Please forgive me for my chutzpah, but it's really like this. That was it for me. You know, I knew I had to be there just as a stoic figure so that my children would see and experience that they had a mother, but who's kidding who? I had died inside. I refused to cook because it was an act of creativity. Dead people don't create. I couldn't get off the couch for many months, let alone out of bed in the morning. And I wasn't interested in actually living again. I was interested in becoming a little bit more healthy, getting over the trauma, but I can actually tell you that year after he died was one of the hardest years of my life. Not just because he died, but because I actually began to go through so many nisayonot that were so strange. Very, very strange. Now there was so much chesed, I can't even tell you if people did. The chesed around the world, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. But for some reason, almost every person, institution, or thing that I depended on at that point, during the year, had made very bad mistakes. I don't blame anyone, and they've done tshuva since. But it's an amazing thing to see that one after the other, anyone that I depended on, I could no longer depend on. And believe me, this was not easy to see how much Hashem was behind it, especially when the stick that Hashem uses is another human being. How easy is it to see that the person that's rude is really just Hashem, you know? It's really just God. It's not really them. I really have something to gain from this experience. It's one of the hardest things there is to do, I think. And these people made such blundering mistakes that it's almost like, how could it possibly be them? How could this possibly be true? But I still couldn't see that it was Hashem, because it just hurt, and it was very disappointing. And I'm not saying this to talk about myself. I'm saying this because now that I'm on the other side, and I so clearly see how every single person that had made grave mistakes was so hashgachically tailored to help my liver regenerate, to help me become alive again and healthy. Because if I wasn't feeling anything, if I wasn't feeling any pain, I could never feel any pleasure again. and I was not interested in feeling anything again. And through all of these struggles, I was forced to feel. I was forced to survive and struggle and get it together, which is something I was not interested in doing. And Hashem, in his ultimate rachmanis, would rather hurt me through kind, loving people doing very stupid things, would rather hurt me in the short term so that I could live and wake up and experience goodness and life in the long term. And I can look back now and say, truly, thank you. There is hashgacha in every single thing that we experience, in every single pain, in every single mistake people make. It is specifically tailored to help us to be healthy in the parts that we are bruised again, that we are bruised with. Specifically, I know in my situation, Hashem did not want me to be dependent on anyone. Hashem wanted to show me that I could do what I thought I could never do, the impossible, to be a self-functioning, single working mother of five rambunctious little kids. And now, had I thought about whether I could do it, I would definitely tell you absolutely not, but I did not have a choice to think. I just had to do. So I bless us all that we should do it not through suffering, but we should know and see what our potential is, without our kind, giving healer Hashem pushing us in those ways. Okay. The mazel of Teves is Capricorn. The Capricorn is a goat. The Capricorn, what's the sign of Capricorn? There's a goat. So what does a goat do? The Midrash Kohelet says that when a child is actually 10, she jumps like a goat. Child, 10, Nisan, the 10th month from Nisan is Teves. Now, this jumping shows how playful it can be. It brings out the spirit in a person. It shows the spirit, the playfulness of a child that grows from immaturity to maturity. When they start to see life with an ayin tov, and an immature child, actually the tribe of Teves is Dan, and Dan actually means to judge. So when we are immature, we're in that stage of immaturity, we judge things with a critical eye. Oh, she's so selfish. So selfish. How could she just not even think about the fact that I could be inconvenienced? And we start to grow up to a child of maturity, a person of maturity where we see things with an ayin tov. Oh, maybe I have that need in me. Maybe I'm just too dependent on her. Maybe I just want so much kindness from other people. And I just have to, you know what? Don't expect anything from other people. Just let go. She has her own stuff. Maybe she didn't get what she needs in her life. And I have to worry about myself and how much I can give and how much I should be considerate to another person. This is about me. Hashem sent this to me because I'm in the school of life. I'm in the middle school of life. And she just taught me a lesson. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I could have gone to a shiur about meals and I could have sat there and worked on it, but instead I feel this real pang inside and I can just work on it now. Thank you. I'm in the seminary of life. The Zohar actually says that the commander and chief of the army of Mashiach is going to be from the tribe of Dan. It's a very big element of Mashiach light, revelation of God in Teves. Right. The Zohar says that the commander of the army of Mashiach will be from the tribe of Dan. From the tribe of Dan. The month of Teves, the tribe is Dan. The Shevet is Dan. And actually, when Yaakov was giving a bracha to Dan about Hatzlacha, he actually saw in the future Shimshon. Shimshon is actually from the tribe of Dan, and he saw in the future that Shimshon, who's defeated, whose hair is cut, who's blind, who's at his last leg, who is humiliated in front of all of the people that he was defeating most of his life, even in that place, in that lowest, lowest place, he still looked up to God. He said, God, give me just a little bit more strength, just one last time. Just one last time, just give me that last strength. And with that last bout of strength, he pulled down two pillars and wound up killing more Plishtim in that moment that he had in his entire life. What was his goal in life? Is to be a great warrior, to kill to kill many, many Pelishtim. I don't get it, but. And look what he did. Look what he did. In his lowest moment, he was able to accomplish the purpose of his life more than he had in any other time. Since my late husband's death, there have been at least 4 siyums of Shas in his merit. Now, I remember I was going out every time he used to finish a sekta, and I always used to encourage him. I used to say, "You're going to finish Shas." You know, someone who's a Baal Tshuva at 22, who's busy running a yeshiva and, you know, not learning Daf Yomi, looked at me and said, "High expectations, wife. You know, halavai." And I was like, "No, you'll do it." But I knew inside, he knew he would never finish Shas. He finished Shas 4 times. Anyway, so I actually, I look to Shimon and I think to myself, that's really the human spirit. You know, that's what we're capable of. I think actually the real mace of Hanukkah is not the oil and the Maccabees and everything else. I look at those lights and I think the real mace is us. It's Am Yisrael. Look what we go through individually. Look what we go through in a cloud. Look at all the years and all, everything, and all of that, from the good to the bad. And we're still here. We're still here and we're still trying. You know, some of us are broken in this way. It's like this army that just like comes back, you know, wounded. One's got this, you know, one arm and one's got a bandage over here. But we're still trying. We're still fighting. We're still fighting the war. We're still trying. We're still trying to do the best that we can. And that's Mamash. I think that's Mamash, the Nes of Hanukkah. That's us. So, Baruch Hashem, I get a Mazel Tov. A few weeks ago, I got married, and I am alive. Whether or not I'm married, I'm alive. But Hashem should just bless us all, that we will see the light, we will see the Tov in the Ra, and wherever we're put at any time, in any moment, with any person or circumstance, no matter how big or how small, it's not about big or small, because we're all brought in to go through whatever we need to go through. And what happens to be hard for someone else could be easy for us. What happens to be easy for someone else is hard for us. But Hashem's going to put us through whatever is hard for us, because those are the places that we know that He knows that we can become healthy again, so that we could come close to Him to be able to greet the Mashiach in our full beauty, in our full light, and reveal it to the world. B'zat Hashem.